richest 1% of this country owns half our country's wealth, $5 trillion. One-third of that comes from hard work, two-thirds comes from inheritance, interest on interest accumulating to widows' idiot sons. You know what I do? Stock and real estate speculation. It's bullshit. You got 90% of the American public out there with little or no net worth. I create nothing. I own. We make the rules, pal. The news, war, peace, spam and upheaval, the price of paperclip. We pick that rabbit out of the hat while everybody sits out there wondering how the hell we did it. Now, you're not naive enough to think we're living in a democracy, are you, buddy?
I've broken every damn law made by God and man. And if they make any more, I'll break those too. I don't know much. This I do know. This country's in a war now, which very few people realize. A crime war. Thousands of lives, billions of dollars of property are lost every year. And you know the best thing you've been able to do so far? Build bigger prisons. And fill them full of men. You fill one, you build another. But still there are more criminals every day and there is no end in sight. This being the case, then, you and your system must somehow be wrong.
But we don't make any demands of the rich. We just want to get rid of the bastards, right?
There was a palace that was a city. It was a palace. It was a palace, and it can be a palace again. A palace in which there is no king or queen or dukes or earls or princes, but subjects, all subjects, beholden to each other to make a better place to live. Is that too much to ask? Are we asking too much of it? Is it beyond our reach? Because if it is, then we are nothing but sheep being herded to the final slaughterhouse. I will not go down that way. I choose to fight back. I choose to rise, not fall. I choose to live, not die. And I know that what's within me is also within you.
You're tuned to Community Radio, 2XX 98.3 FM, and you're with James and Stephen on Radio Freedom. Anarchy on the airways. And if you want to know what anarchy is all about, anarchist society is a non-hierarchical society in which all people have equal access to the decision-making powers of that society and equal access to the society's wealth. And that's something James is going to be touching on a little bit later, or at least in terms of the equal decision-making power, when we have a little more discussion about voting formal today, direct democracy tomorrow, and sort of have a little discussion about direct democracy. Also on the program this week, well, rich bastards, fat rich bastards, and even fatter rich bastards. I mean, I think in the news this week has just been a flood of fat rich bastards, in particular the chairman, or the outgoing chairman of AMP, who got his nice $13 million handshake this week, which I thought is absolutely outrageous. And I also thought the comments of the Australian Shareholders Association, who were a bit disgusting too, because their concern is not so much that this guy has screwed $30 million plus out of the employees of AMP. They just didn't get their share in their share as well. Other fat rich bastards, the Queen's coming to Australia, unfortunately, in the very near future.
Is she?
Just in case you hadn't noticed. Before the Olympics, though, so Jackboot Johnny can have his little 15 minutes of glory. Hopefully hopefully he'll slip over on the dais or something, or when they light Olympic torch, he'll have a nasty accent and burn his balls or something. But
I remember when the Queen last came, I went down the airport and metal detecting everyone, including the kids. So
you had your little flag there, did you, James?
No, I had a camera.
You had a camera. I got all these awful pictures of, you know, all these little kiddies waving their flags, you know, when the Queen comes. And then these the sort of people who think this is a wonderful thing are those who turn around when they see pictures from protests overseas with little kiddies there and say, oh, this is disgusting, little kiddies not having any, you know, which is... I mean, it's quite true. I mean, these kids don't have any idea what's happening, but, you know, what's the difference between that and making them, you know, go wave the flag when the bloody Queen comes?
Yeah.
But, well, most of the flag of the Queen now is a very short item. Her visit's going to cost $1.5 million. Now, obviously, I mean, you can have all your little security bullshit and all that, but, yes, and, you know, other wastes of money. I mean, they don't really care if she, you know, someone gets an egg in her mouth or something. Yeah. Interesting target practice for any budding Olympic. Are there any Olympic sports involving throwing eggs or similar objects in a certain direction? Target shooting. So they could get all the target shooters out for a bit of practice. But what astounded me is that the government spokesperson on this issue said that most of that cost would be airfares. I mean, $1.5 million to fly How many people are they flying out, and what are they flying them out on? That's going to cost $1.5 million, and that is incredible.
Can't you buy a whole 747 for $1 million?
No. Not even close, James, but...
How much are they, 100?
Maybe looking... be in the tens of millions at least. Yeah. They do take a while to build, you could probably buy a share in a 747.
Well, you never hear about national debt.
But... you could probably buy an American Airlines 747 or something for $1.5 million. Mm-hmm. But now, even a first class return airfare to Britain is only about $11,000 or so. So where's this $1.5 million? How many people are they bloody flying out, and you know, what sort of conditions? There's every little parasite in the royal family coming out. There must be a fair few of them, but I don't know. There are better things we could be spending $1.5 million on than flying Liz and Co. out, and hopefully she'll get the welcome she deserves. Also on the show today, industrial action. There's been a spate of industrial action across the country this week. We've seen railway workers in Queensland on strike. We've seen power workers in Victoria on strike. And there's one who I just completely forget who else went on strike this week. That's right, BHP coal miners went on strike as well. So we've seen a fair bit of workers taking a bit of direct action in defence of their rights this week, which is always pleasing to see. And of course, building workers in Victoria went on strike as well, so we'll be talking a little bit about industrial action and a few other miscellaneous things today. But I'm going to start off today with a little thing about censorship, because the acting director of the censorship board, or whatever they call themselves these days, a man who goes by the name of Simon Webb, came out with this sort of outrageous statement on Wednesday, saying that maybe the Australian public is now ready for a debate on sex in films. It's like, what the hell is that supposed to mean, that we're ready for a debate on sex in films? Now, who is this little patronised little bastard, you know, who gets paid how much money for being a director of the censorship board? I mean, what a job there it is. You get paid to watch films all day. I mean, how many people out there, you know, unemployed people would be saying, how the hell where do you get a job like this where you get paid to watch bloody films all day?
Well, it's the Board of Film and Literature Classification.
That's the one.
Yeah.
And, and if unemployed people went and watched movies all day, there'd be a bloody uproar. This self-patronising little bastard, Simon Webb, you know, not only does he get paid for it, he gets paid to come up with statements like the Australian public is ready for a debate on, you know, sex in films. Now, it seems to be missing the point is that what right does this, you know, little group, which is, you know, stacked by Richard Alston, because basically the Minister for Communications gets to appoint this group, you know, there's no sort of, so to any unemployed people out there wondering how you would get this job, well, you know, be friends with Richard Alston seems to be the best way to do it, and be a very conservative person from a social viewpoint too might help.
Yeah, there's a very joking sort of community consultation group as well that was about, you know, as representatives, that funny little constitutional assembly thing we had.
But anyway, the whole point is if a film is made with the full consent of all the actors and directors and caterers and stunt doubles and whatever else involved, why should that be... You know, what right does any self-appointed group have to say, that doesn't conform with community standards? I mean, who decides what community standards are? And I thought the whole point of having this rating system was so that someone could say, that film's got violence and sex and drug use and people using bad language and whatever else. Gee, I don't like films with sex and drugs and violence and people using bad language, so I won't go and see it. Now, are people so... do these people think we're so stupid that we can't, you know, read those little letters that they put in the movie ads and in the cinemas and all that and make up our own bloody minds about what they want to see?
Apart from sex and violence, there's also other categories. There's like another category called RC, which is refused classification. And for the life of me, I can't find out what that actually means. I've looked through all their website and stuff, but no, they can even ban something outright because it's just too ideologically unsound.
Amongst other things. And it's just, we are not morons out here. I think we are completely capable of making choices about what we want to watch. And if a film is made with the full consent of all people involved, then... You know, what can these people possibly have against people watching it? And if people don't want to watch it, then they don't have to watch it. No one's forcing them. And if you walk into a movie called, you know, Gore Guts 5, which has got, you know, violence, sex, horror and all that in it, and you think, and you walk into it, and then you walk out halfway through because you don't like horror movies, then that's really no one's fault but your own. And, of course, Richard Alston, being the very nice person he is, says, we do it for the children. We do this to protect children. We censor the internet to protect children and all this other bullshit. If five-year-old kids are going into R-rated, you know, or X-rated porn films or something, then whose fault's that? I mean, it's not the fault of the film distributors. Well, you know, it's not the... I suppose it probably is the fault of the person selling tickets who, you know, let this five-year-old kid in. But, you know, are these... you know, a parent of these kids so completely devoid of any, you know, responsibility that they would let their 5-year-old kid go see a blue film or a snuff film or something?
There's also the other argument that it's to protect the children, and that, you know, we need these new censorship laws to stop, like, you know, stuff like pedophilia, and they use the same argument from that. But the thing is that making pedophile pornography and pedophilia in itself is already illegal. So censoring it...
Exactly, it's true. I mean, there are laws against child abuse and sexual abuse and all that sort of thing. You know, people who are filming these things are already engaging in the sexual abuse and the child abuse. The fact that they're filming it just puts them under another, you know, another law as well. So, and it's been singularly unsuccessful at stopping child abuse. I mean, it doesn't mean you have one of these wanker arguments that we then legalise child abuse, of course. There's laws against child abuse. If a film is made involving child abuse or child sexual abuse, then that film, you know, is breaking those laws on child abuse. So why do you need another law to censor it? It's not being made with the consent of the people involved, so therefore that's fine. Go after those films. If you've got films that are made with the consent of people involved that show, I mean, who, you know, whatever, put those little warnings on and let people make up their own minds. It's a completely ludicrous argument. And so... I don't know, I mean, if we're mature enough to have a debate on whether there should be sex in films, it means there shouldn't be a debate on whether there should be sex on films. If people want to make films with sex, then let them go ahead. People who don't want to watch them, don't watch them. People who want to watch them, and I mean, who cares? And I suppose there's an argument people sometimes put out that, violent films will lead to people being violent, and porn films will lead to, you know, people committing rapes. I mean, we'll put your evidence up. You know, you've never come up with any evidence to prove that. And so until such time as you can, then, you know, you've got no argument in that area. And I dare say that your motives are something completely different.
Yeah, because the thing is, I mean, you know, we have no special interest in, you know, these, you know, that sort of rape and stuff. It's that this is very dangerous, that if once we start censoring things now, it just goes on and on and on until you just have everything censored. And it's the whole, like, 1984 situation whereby, you know, it was when our freedom of speech... is impaired, so is our freedom of thought.
Yeah, and exactly, and again, it also comes back down to another topic, who is making those decisions? It's this not self-appointed, Richard Austin-appointed group who does it. And so they'll decide, I don't know, a porn film's bad, we won't allow it, because it depicts sex in it. And people might go, oh, great, you know, this is great porn, awful stuff. Then the next thing they come along to classify as a sex education film, which has, funnily enough, sex in it. Oh, that's terrible, we'll get rid of that too. And soon... You know, and films with, I mean, adult themes is another one of these stupid classifications, you know, ratings that they use. What's an adult theme? Well, according to the Australian Broadcasting Authority, it has, I mean, sort of topics of an adult nature or, would, you know, of a sort of nature that would require, you know, mature mind to understand. That might be politics. The next thing you do is you're banning any film that sort of says, you know, governments aren't nice, big business isn't nice, small business isn't nice, if they're exploiting their workers too. And that's exactly what you do. The dangerous thing is, as soon as you put censorship in the hands of, you know, the state or any other self-appointed group, then, you know, that they will happily use that against you, just as they'll use it to your benefit, if they ever do.
Well, and news has just come out in the last 36 hours saying that an American airline company has went to the federal court in America and got a court order to go and raid their employees' homes and search their hard drives for emails that had called for a non-union endorsed slowdown campaign, and it seems that the laws that says it, there is actually laws out there. This is in America, and we're always, you know, not that far behind America. that you can't, I mean, to slander a company on the internet or anywhere, you can then be prosecuted by the company in question because you're defaming them. I mean, this is terrible for our free speech rights. And if you can't talk about something, then, you know...
Yeah. Well, it's actually quite interesting thing you brought up on a slightly different, well, completely different topic. You actually brought up the issue of defamation. Actually, in the ACT, the government's actually making moves to change the defamation laws such to the point that basically more or less gives newspapers a fair degree of open slather on politicians and the like, which is absolutely fantastic to see. And I think if we want to call John Howard a complete bastard, which he is, I think we should be able to say he's a complete bastard. And we've reasons too. I mean, we could go into the list of all the reasons we think he's a complete bastard for. I mean, we wouldn't just say he's a complete bastard for the hell of it, even though he is. But, you know, those sort of things now, I mean, I don't think John Howard would ever try and sue anyone for calling him a complete bastard, because he wouldn't have a pot to piss in court on that one. But And all these, defamation lawyers and politicians have come up in arms saying, oh, this is a terrible thing to have. You know, this basically gives newspapers the right to say anything. And basically what the law actually has a rider on there is that if newspapers have done their research, they can basically say what they want about people, which is, what's wrong with that situation? If they, found out that Jeff Kenneth is corrupt, then they should be able to say that Jeff Kennedy is corrupt. If they found out that John Howard is a complete bastard, then they should be able to say he's a complete bastard. The similar thing is, you want to, point out all the awful, nasty things that Kerry Packer does with his money that he doesn't earn, like not paying any tax, and, that he's engaged in various dubious activities, not that we're saying he did, because as far as we know, he hasn't. those are the sort of things that people have a right to know about, these supposed great leaders in our society. Okay, executive salaries, talking about fat rich bastards like Kerry Packer. Ex-director or chief executive, whatever they call themselves, of AMP has walked away with a whatever it was, still enough to, you can put that in the bank on, in an everyday savings account, the interest in that would pay, would keep you in a very nice lifestyle. I'm sure even at 0.5% you'd be doing a right on $13 million. We've said on this show countless times before, the executives do not earn their salary. That's just theft from the employee. In this case, the people who work in AMP insurance offices, whatever. And basically that's money that those employees create. It's value they create, and basically gets appropriated by the board of directors to pay executive salaries, managerial salaries, and other sundry people who are decreased productivity in these organisations. Certainly decrease the per capita productivity in these organisations. But what really got me about this was not so much this guy, walked away with $13 million, because you'd expect that, but this little group called the Australian Shareholders Association has come out saying, oh, this is disgraceful, this is an underperforming company, whatever that's supposed to mean. And this guy, basically that means he's not making enough money for those, probably meant it only managed to screw $2 billion out of its workers rather than, three or four. And isn't it disgraceful this guy walks away with $13 million? Now, you might say, here are some little investors standing up against big greedy bastards like the former chief executive officer of AMP. But where's the difference between a shareholder who owns two shares and gets a dollar dividend a year and the chief executive officer getting $13 million or whatever? At the end of the day, that money, whether it's $13 million or $13, is not money you have earned, it's not money these investors have earned, it is money that has been appropriated from the employees of that company for the purpose of paying a dividend to these shareholders. Now, unfortunately, virtually every Australian worker these days is a shareholder indirectly through superannuation. So much we can do about that's actually enforced by law that your employer has to pay you this much money. But so we don't have any gripes against those people, but people who are going out and buying shares, basically think about what you're doing. You go out to work and you whinge about basically getting screwed at work all day, which is true. And part of the money, if you're in a private company, which is a private public company, so to speak, a publicly listed company, i.e. one that's on the stock exchange, and you're working for one of them, then you're getting exploited at work, you're getting, value that you produce is getting taken away from you, and part of that money goes to pay shareholders in that company who may be just small investors like you. And so, if you're going to whinge about getting screwed in your company while you're screwing, simultaneously taking money off other people, that's an absolute, stuffed situation. And it was laughable when, the government came up this week saying, oh, Australia's the biggest per capita shareholding in the world, when most of that was actually from, the fact that, 7 million people out there have superannuation and therefore they actually counted that as shareholdings. So what would I, encourage people, don't buy shares. I mean, I know it might sound attractive and you have dickheads like Paul Clitheroe in his little money program on Channel 9 saying, oh, buy shares in this, buy shares in that. Because really, at the end of the day, the money you get from those investments in shares, the wonderful return on your investment, is money that is basically stolen from the employees of those companies that you invest in, whether it's a mining company, bank, whatever else you're investing in, that is Telstra even, that is money that is being stolen, from those people. And you want to talk about Telstra, I mean, one of the reasons phone charges are so bloody high in this country is so Telstra can make a nice profit and pay high dividend. If they weren't able to do that, there would be a definite opportunity for, phone calls to be a lot cheaper than they are. So I sort of find the whingings of the Australian Shareholders Association a bit hollow, because, they are really, at the end of the day, while they're not taking $13 million out of the workers' pockets of those companies, when you combine them, they are taking a fair bit out, and it is money that they haven't earned. Okay, on to industrial action now. We have seen a fair bit of industrial action this week. I'm going to skip over very briefly to some of the things. In terms of the Victorian power supply, we're going to leave that to the able hands of Joe Toscano in Annika's World this week, who we'll be crossing to very shortly, but just a few things. On Monday in Victoria, building unions had a one-day strike, and it's a strike they intend to basically hold once a month until they get their demand, which is a 36-hour week, and a $24 per week pay rise, which is something that we can certainly empathise with. And we say, don't stop at 36 hours, try 30 or even 26, even better. It'll be a wonderful thing. You have more free time, there'll be unemployment will disappear, and all those other wonderful things. So we say we certainly do encourage everyone, no matter what work you do, to sort of definitely fight for a shorter working week. Now, the MBA, the Master Builders Association in Victoria, of course, was all up in arms about this and was whinging about, oh, this costs, you know, employees $23 million. Well, boo-hoo, that, no. It cost workers $23 million, but they voluntarily chose to forego that money, as well as their salaries. Now, if you want to steal that money from them, well, that's your tough luck. You don't turn around and whinge about losing it. But their laughable comment was, unions had put employers' backs to the walls. Well, that's exactly where they bloody well should put them, and they should be doing it on a more regular basis. And apart from putting their backs to the walls, get their backs off the walls and basically screw them everything you can get out of them. And if that means a shorter working week and more pay, then it's something we should absolutely encourage people to go for. And don't listen to the crap like the RBA, Reserve Bank of Australia, came out with this week saying, now, have wage rises to compensate for the GST or damage Australia's economic position. It's crap. Inflation is caused by people putting their prices up. You have companies making massive profits. They can't afford it to pay higher wages. If they can't afford, let them put their books on the table and let them independently be audited to prove that they cannot pay a higher wage. And most of these companies, a lot of big companies, can afford to absorb pay rises into their profits. So it's an absolute lie to say that's going to, you know, cause inflation. Though I suppose if people have more money, they can, you know, basically all the supply and demand will probably put prices up, but, you know, when people say wage rises cost money because businesses have to put their prices up to cover for that, then it's a load of absolute bollocks. And speaking of GST wage rises, the RBA also said that people are being compensated for with tax cuts, and therefore that they don't need, they don't need wage rises. Well, I had this little, at work we've got this wonderful little thing sent around which allow you to calculate how much better off you will be under the GST tax cuts. Now, mine comes to a grand total of $19 a week, which is pretty good. I'm not complaining about getting extra $19 a week. But in my salary, that represents, maybe, I'm just trying to do a calculation in my head, my after-tax salary, $19, represents probably a bit under 4%. Now, GST is 10%. Now, of course, they'll say, oh, all your taxes are coming off, so prices won't really go up 10%. But in the last week, we've seen petrol jump by about 10 cents a litre. Grocery stores have been putting prices up quite regularly over the last 6 months or so, and so I dare say prices are going to be going up by a lot more than the 2 or 3% that Richard Alston, Peter Costello, the Treasury keeps telling us they will go up by. In fact, the New Zealand Treasury came out this week and said the price actually went up by about 8%, or is it 12%, when they put their GST in. So I think a little 4% pay rise to compensate for 10 or 12% inflation, unfortunately for the Reserve Bank, that's nothing. So I think if people want to get pay rise for the GST, you never need an excuse to go for a pay rise. I mean, until you get every cent that you owed, you should always be going for pay rises. So I think that's a load of bollocks to be saying that, you know, pay rises are going to cause inflation. It's absolutely not true. Now, other industrial action, railway workers in Queensland have gone on strike and in defiance of Supreme Court orders or federal court orders, naughty, naughty boys and girls, how dare you, disobey laws that are stacked against you. And Peter Beattie has come out with the usual crap about, oh, this is not in the best interest of the state and it's not in the best interest of Australia, which, as we always know, means it's not in the best interest of business. So I think people should be proud to stand up and say we are doing something that is not in the best interest of Australia, because that always means the best interest of employers when they're talking about that. And again, we do support, you know, people taking direct action in our support of better workplace conditions, better pay rises, and most importantly, a shorter working week. And finally, while we're talking about industrial things, before we are across to the anarchist world this week, workplace entitlements. I'm talking about sick leave, long service leave, holiday leave, and the like. And our wonderful, caring government has this week announced that they will pay $4 million in entitlements to workers at National Textiles Company, and this is in addition to the $7 million they will apparently get well, should get from the sale of assets of that company. Now, I do not begrudge these workers getting that money one bit, but why is it only happening in a couple of things? Why is it only happening in this case? Would it have anything to do with the fact that John Howard's brother owns this company? You know, bailing this guy out so he doesn't have to meet his responsibilities. The second thing, there are many other cases where where companies have gone belly up and workers have lost their rightful entitlements and the government has not come to bail them out. Now, while I don't begrudge these people, I don't see why the hell me or any other taxpayer, well, I'm talking about working taxpayers, I don't give a stuff about business taxpayers, they seem to be a very dying breed these days, I don't see why I should be having to pay those entitlements. Those entitlements should be, set aside at the time they're due. So if people are accumulating 2 days' holiday per week or per month or whatever, then that the money to cover that should be paid out at the time it's happening. It should be put in some bank account or stashed under the boss's mattress or whatever happens to it. But the money should be there at the time. In the same way that your superannuation is paid now, it's not, you don't wait till you're 60 and you're retired, although in the case of the ACT government, that seems to be their method. It gets paid weekly or monthly or whenever you get paid. It doesn't just get, you don't wait till you're 60 and realise, gee, we've got to pay these guys, their superannuation. So it's money that should be set, and companies should be made to set aside this, money for these entitlements, long service leave, holiday leave, whatever, as it accrues. It shouldn't be left up to other, to other workers to bail these people out. It should be up to the company who is stealing money from their employees every day, to set aside that money for their entitlements. All right. Was James, anything further to add? Any of that? Yeah, I might take a quick break for some music, actually, before we cross to the anarchist world this week. Our music this week is coming from Sick of It All, and this is a track off their, I think it's not so new album anymore. This is the title track, and it's Call to Arms. That was Sick of It All with a track called Call to Arms. You're tuned to Community Radio 2XX, 98.3 FM, and this is Radio Freedom Anarchy on the airwaves. I'd just like to remind listeners, in case I didn't know, that 2XX will be holding an open day in our studios and offices on Saturday the 26th of February from, I can't remember the time, it's in the afternoon anyway. Basically we do encourage people to come along and basically see how 2XX operates, maybe find out a bit more about the station and how you can get involved in the station.
Yeah, I was just talking about, I talked just before about that airline company. I was just wondering if anyone doubts my source, they can check it out. I'm pretty sure it's on the ANFOS news list, which is www.anfos.ca/en.
Yes, we always check our sources if we defame people. Therefore, we can't get in trouble under this new ACT legislation if it gets through. Okay, we are going to cross now via our very helpful and handy community radio satellite to the studios of 3CR in Melbourne and to the ever pleasant voice of Joe Toscano and his wonderful Queensland accent. Well, sorry, I'm being bigoted there, aren't I? To Joe Toscano and Michael Smith. And the Anarchist World this week, and they're going to be talking about, on the topic of industrial action and the like, they're going to be talking about the Victorian power workers' strike.
But let's start off on hostages. Now, I'm confused, Michael. I must be very simple. Mm. I'm a very simple soul at the best of time, but I'm...
What's confusing you?
I'm very confused. I'm exceptionally confused.
By?
I'm confused about this power dispute that's occurring in Victoria. Now, I like to keep abreast of what's going on. I'm like you. I read the newspapers, listen to the news. And I thought to myself, now, the Victorian community has been held hostage. Now, that's obvious because there was a blackout early last week, this week, and then there's now a brownout at the present time. So somebody, somewhere, is denying the Victorian people electricity. So I consider that I'm a hostage.
That's right.
And I thought that looking at these learned journals that I would find out who was responsible for this hostage crisis, because I was a little bit browned off about a lot of things that occurred over the last few weeks. And I thought, well, if I know who's responsible, then I can direct my anger and venom in that regard.
Fair enough.
Yeah, which is fair enough. I mean, people provide a service in a capitalist society. They don't provide the service. Well, we sue the bastards. I mean, that's the way it works. That's what we're told to do. So here I was, flicking through the papers, listening to the radio, and even watch the TV, trying to find out who's this bastard. Who are these bloody terrorists behind this hostage crisis in Victoria? And everybody said it was these unionists.
Mm.
These grotty little worker types who are out there at your lawn.
Controlling this big corporation.
Keeping the nation or the Victorian people and the South Australian people, let's not forget the South Australian people, hostage. Because these bastards, these scum, these unionists had pulled the plug on the state's power supply. And I thought to myself, well, let's get out there and smash some heads in. Let's do it the old way and get this electricity going back. And I thought to myself, now, this doesn't make sense. Well, other newspapers tell me it's the bastardly unions and the stupid workers, and the television tells me it's these horrible working types, and the radio tells me it's these horrible workers. It just doesn't add up.
No.
Because they want to go back to work. They want job security. They would love to die.
They want to get paid.
They want to get paid. They love to die at Latrobe Valley, which I think is a bit silly, but they want job security. And then I looked into it a bit further and I thought, ah, maybe this has got something to do with the privatisation. And then I realised that this British transnational corporation that specialises in energy, especially in energy production, had bought the Yallourn Power Station, which provides 27% electricity to Victoria and South Australia. And then I looked into it a bit further, and it looks like these people who now own, they call themselves Yallourn Energy, who knows who the parent company is, I found out, you know, a bit slow, that they don't want people to collectively bargain.
No.
And they want people on individual contracts.
It's easier.
And it looks like, Michael, this whole dispute revolves around the fact that this transnational corporation, the old colonialists, want to come back to Victoria and de-unionise the workplace. So they've got individual contracts and they're able to bash people across the head with these individual contracts. So I thought to myself, well, maybe the workers aren't the terrorists. Maybe the terrorists is this transnational corporation, this British transnational corporation. Maybe they're the ones who are holding the Victorian community to ransom. And I thought, oh, well, that makes sense. Those bastards are holding the community.
Mm-hmm.
And then my suspicions were confirmed. Because there's this forced negotiation process between three trade unions, Yallourn Energy, the British multinational transnational corporation, their heads were pushed together by the state government, and they had an independent arbitrator called the Mr. Neil Pope, I think his name was. And they negotiated for 40 or 50 hours straight, and at the end of the negotiation period, look, they had some type of agreement. And guess what? The terrorists, the real terrorists, Yallourn Energy, pulled out and said, we weren't interested in this. This was just a ploy to buy us time. Rip, rip, rip. They went, rip, rip, rip. That's your agreement. We don't give a shit about your agreement. And I thought to myself, ah, well, at least the newspapers will report that the next day.
No.
They'll tell us. Front page news. Terrorists exposed. Yallourn Energy, terrorists. Hold Victorian community to ransom. Demand individual contracts. Front page headlines.
Don't think so.
Didn't happen.
No.
Michael, I'm just distraught.
No.
Didn't happen.
You can still blame the unionists.
They were demanding too much. They said they'll force back to work. Good old Brax government did the right thing. We'll find them. Blame the unions. They're the terrorists. They're the scum. They're the ones who want to collectively bargain. They're the ones who want a reasonable wage. They're the ones who want, you know, reasonable conditions. And they want job security. Could you imagine it? And they want to bargain collectively. The scum. They're not willing to go one person at a time to the boss at Yallourn Energy and say, excuse me, I'd like a wage rise. So, boys and girls, and I know most of our listeners have got a brain, half a brain possibly. So, boys and girls, we know who the real terrorists are. It's not the working people of this country. If you look at who's made the profits in the last 10 years, it's not the working people of this country. It's not the wage earners who've got to battle for $5 or $10 or $20. It's these bastards who make billions of dollars through screwing us. And yes, we are held hostages. We are hostages. We're hostages to transnational corporations. We're hostages to their shareholders. We're hostages to their desires to create profits irrespective of the human and social costs. And what we are seeing in Victoria is what we are seeing in West Australia and South Australia and Queensland and New South Wales is corporations being aided and abetted by Peter Reith, the Minister for Industrial Warfare, and the federal government trying, attempting, bribing, pushing people onto individual contracts so they can no longer collectively bargain and protect what they have won over the last few years. If you look at the situation, go back into history to the 1890s. The same thing happened in Australia in the 1890s. And what do you think happened, Michael, when the employers actually won that dispute and people were on individual contracts? What do you think happened to all those glorious individual contracts within 2 years?
Wages went down, conditions went down.
and the unions were reformed. Not that I've got much time for these tame unions, but I think the important thing to remember is this is not a dispute about wages and conditions. It's essentially a dispute about individual contracts and job security. And we do have terrorists in the community, and they do wear suits and ties, and they speak nicely, and they do own the means of communication, and they do own the radio stations and the newspapers. I know I sound like a bit paranoid this morning, you know, and the television stations, and they've browbeaten the ABC into submission.
Mm.
We all know about that. And that's what we see every day. And that's what we see, manufactured news, which has nothing to do with reality, but more to do with their bottom lines. So if you're looking for scapegoats, if you're looking for terrorists, just go to the stock exchange, get the names of a few big companies, and you'll find out who's holding whom to ransom, who tells the government what to do. Look at how the BRACS government is twisting and turning because there's a little bit of an investment strike in Victoria. It doesn't take long, you know, for an investment strike to get its...
To bring out their true colours.
Well, that's right, but we know that. Michael knows
that. We're expecting it.
We know that, but I think... It really amazes me that people still seem to, you know, swallow the line. It's those greedy, ugly, disgusting unionist types who are holding the community to ransom. And we know it's those people who are trying to break people's organisations, which have banned, where people have banded together to protect their own interests. That's where the real terrorists lie, and the real terrorists in this country aren't even governments anymore. It's transnational corporations. They're the real terrorists. It's not the protesters on the streets throwing a few rocks and smashing a few windows. That's not the real terrorists. It's not governments these days, because they're so bloody weak. You know, they bend whenever a transnational corporation coughs. It's these mega merger types. It's these transnational corporations. They hold the cards. And what we've seen in Victoria in the last 4 weeks is an excellent example of what happens when these people, you know, flex their muscles. And the struggle isn't over yet. It's only begun, because the only way Reef and Howard and the rest of his cohorts can get their legislation to work is by people being on individual contracts. And as long as people collectively bargain, they will be able to break down the current industrial legislation.
We here at Radio Freedom would like to remind every worker that their country needs them to do the right thing. Take a pay cut. God knows, your poor boss is desperate for the money. Work longer hours without overtime. Your employment duties need you more than your family and friends. Tell your lover that if you get killed at work, not to complain. The company is right to cut health and safety. It's a tough global economy, you know. Don't listen to the troublemaking unionists. You know the boss really loves you and will do the right thing by everyone. If you see the police beating up on young people, Aboriginals, unionists, or the mentally ill, don't do anything. Just remember, they're hardly trade professionals who are doing a very difficult job. How could they do anything wrong? Don't believe those ridiculous rumours that cops control the local drug trade. It's only a very few rotten apples that spoil the force. Give up your rights to the politicians. Participate in our democracy less. You're only getting in the way. Leave it to business and the major parties. They know what you want better than you know yourself. Do this, and you'll be doing right by our great country. On the other hand, you could fight back against what's right for our country and live a longer, happier life, free from oppression by politicians and bosses. It's your choice.
You are listening to Radio Freedom Anarchy on the airwaves on the community radio, 2XX98.3 FM. And just remind you again, 2XX Open Day, 26th of February. For more details, 62300 or 100. Righto, vote informed today, direct democracy tomorrow.
That's right. Well, Stephen and I just had a little vote, and hooray, we're a vote informed today, direct democracy tomorrow branch.
Isn't democracy wonderful? You know? It's the two of us, and we'll just take over the whole world soon.
So we're in a...
Sarcasm alert for those people out there who just didn't quite get that one.
yeah, so, I mean...
most of you don't know what Vote Informal Today Direct Democracy is. We were listening to Joe Toscano. This is a campaign that Joe and his lot at the Anarchist Media Institute started.
His lot. That's such a pleasant description.
And it was based on like previous campaigns they'd run. They run candidates in the, I think they ran a constitutional convention. They ran for two regional elections.
Yep, and I think there's also another group down there who who's that? That crazy guy who tried to get everyone to put equal numbers down their ballot paper, I think.
Oh, what's his name?
His name escapes us for the moment, but he's done a fair few. Is it Arthur someone is? No, no. Can't remember.
Yeah, he's the one who he said, like, you know, do 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 4, 4,
or whatever. Yeah. He's valid, and he's sort of as a candidate a few times too, basically calling more or less for informal votes as well. So it's something unusual, and not so much also informal votes, but sort of also promising that should they be elected, they would not take their seats. And I think there's a current campaign in Brisbane for mayor, I think, even.
Yeah, they're running for it. There's, I think, a guy called Brian Level. He's running for the mayor position, and if he gets voted in, he's going to promise not to sit.
Which, to be quite honest, he's not going to make any great difference from the way these councils currently operate. At least he's just being upfront and honest about it. I mean, he's not going to take the salary either. This might emphasise that.
Yes. So you might be wondering, what's the point? Now, the point is that it's just like the name says. If you vote informal today, then we'll be heading towards direct democracy tomorrow. But the thing, the question is begged, what is direct democracy? Now, to answer that, we need to look at what we have at the situation. Like, I mean, we'd all agree that we live in a democracy. But what we live in is what's known as a representative democracy, as opposed to a direct democracy. And
Even delegated democracy.
Yeah.
We'll get into that technical details a bit later. Well, probably right now, actually.
With a representative democracy, what you do is you get out there, as you know, and vote every 3-4 years on the federal level and at the local level. And what you do is you give your democratic power to these representatives, and they go off and they represent you. Now, there's many, many problems with this, and that it's just one. Just the logical question of how many people are there? How many MPs are there? Federal MPs are there in Canberra?
Three in Canberra. There are two members of the House of Representatives, and there are two senators in Canberra.
All right, so four people for a population of, what is it? What do we have?
300,000 or so.
It's still about 300,000. So we're looking at, you know, 90, 80,000 people each. Now, just think about it yourself. Could you represent 80,000 people? Do you think, are they superhumans? Can they represent 80,000 people? No, they can't. So, also, if we look at the real, you know, the what goes on in Parliament, the fact that even with this pretty poor representative democracy, power is taken away from these representatives and is rolled into the big party structure, whereby we've got Liberal and Labour monopolising what's going on in Parliament, and you've got the Liberal Party, or is in at the moment, and they can do what the hell they want. And you've got the Liberal Party hacks who keep everyone in line, and then basically the Prime Minister with, you know, his small cabinet basically gets the they write the rules. So we've got our little country of wasn't 20 million at the moment.
Oh yeah, sounds good enough.
About 20 million, about 20 run million. By basically, yep. Was it Howard and 12 guys in cabinet?
And also people will say, oh, but the Senate's there to you know, act as the House of Review and stop unfettered power. And we often hear these people saying, oh, you know, the Democrats or some other small party is holding the country to ransom and not letting the elected government govern. If you actually sat down, if you ever have just a week of boredom, get along to the National Library and have a look at Hansard or something, and basically just look through it and actually see how many votes that the Labor and Liberal parties vote together on. And it's about 95% of all legislation that goes before Parliament that those two parties vote on. So this, you know, this notion of you know, the Democrats or some other small party holding the government to ransom is a load of crap.
Also, I don't know that much about the Constitution, Stephen, but this idea that you have the government and the opposition, is that actually entrenched in the Constitution at all?
There is nothing about... Okay, what the Constitution says is you have an election, you have a House of Reps, you have a Senate. The Prime Minister must come from the House of Representatives, the Ministers may come from... maybe picked from anywhere, but they must, within 3 months of being appointed, take up a seat in the House of Representatives or the Senate, and they could come from any party, the Governor General tomorrow could appoint the entire Democrats as, you know, the, well, they couldn't announce the Prime Minister because none of them are in the House of Reps, but the Treasurer, Minister for Finance, Minister for Defence, anyone, they could all become from the Democrats tomorrow. There's nothing stopping the Governor General doing that.
I think this whole adversarial thing of, you know, the government and the opposition is, in fact, you know, it's made up.
It's very much a historical thing from the British Parliament. The way the British Parliament was, you know, created was very much like that in the early days. It was, you know, once the party system sort of came in, that's the way it went. But there's nothing formally entrenched in the Constitution or anything that says there must be a government, there must be an opposition.
And as we know, the two big parties are very influenced by corporations, because they, you know, they pay for their election campaigns and they give them all little perks when they do it. The representatives give them the right decisions that they want. But even if you look at the system in its, like, in its pure form, that we have people who represent us, you know, and we have people, you know, the Senate, who make sure nothing nasty happens. Even looking in that way, it looks pretty dodgy that they could represent us in this way. So what we anarchists we talk about is a thing called direct democracy. This is whereby, instead of giving away our power to these people for a whole three or four years, we participate in democracy directly. We don't give it away. And this means that we, in our local areas, like in our local area where we have a group of people who could realistically sit down and work with each other, we work with each other. For example, your workplace. Now, there's no reason why people can't run their workplace. I mean, you've got the manager. This is this idea that the manager runs everything. I mean,
now, all honesty, if anyone with a job knows, the manager is probably the greatest impediment to improve productivity in any workplace. I mean, they really are so, you know, I mean, for a start, they cannot possibly know everything that's happening in the, you know, in the workplace. They're just one person. The second thing, because they're not the ones implementing any decisions.
These managers who are given their power by the corporation owners, who then go up and up to the shareholders. We can get rid of all that. We can have the workers controlling the workplace. We can have the people who live in an area controlling their area. Now, of course, there's things that have to be done on larger and larger areas, such as, you know, we won't go into this sort of what-if situation because it can just go on forever, but stuff like water, sewage, that sort of thing. Now, instead of having representatives, we can have things called delegates. This is whereby a community or a workplace can delegate a person to go off and not represent, but transmit their decisions to a larger body of people. And this means that if this person goes off and they don't put your decision, the decision that the workplace has made, then this person gets recalled and the decision is nulled. And in this way, it is quite feasible that we could go off and we could have larger and larger delegations that, which are in these independent autonomous areas, which are then grouped together called federations, and these delegates to do it. There's no reason why we can't federate in larger and larger scales, whole countries, whole continents. Now, there's arguments that are used against direct democracy, and like I think you'll probably hear them with this direct vote and formal direct democracy tomorrow campaign, which is that, well, what's the first one? It's people are too stupid to do direct democracy. So what have we got to say to that?
Well, people would be too stupid if they weren't informed. If you're not going to inform people on what they're making a decision on, then of course they can't make a sensible decision on it. And yeah, that's the way things now. Where does information on various things and various issues come from? By and large, it comes from government, it comes from media outlets who all filter it to suit their own purposes. And so if people aren't informed on the decisions they're having to make, informed on the issues they're having to make decisions about, of course they can't make a sensible decision.
Have you ever noticed in your workplace that about a large chunk of the boss's job is actually to keep information from you, to make sure that the information flow is always going up, not down? But there's also this thing that, yeah, normal people are too stupid, and there's this idea that, oh no, but, you know, Mr. Howard, he's not stupid. He's an honourable, very smart man.
But he's a lawyer. I mean, what would he know about sewage works? Engineers know about sewage works, so why do we have a lawyer making decisions about sewage works? Now, of course, this doesn't mean we hand over the operation of the sewage works to a bunch of engineers, but it's the whole point that, you know, people, you know, that currently these people have no idea what their portfolios, by and large. Most of them are lawyers and economists. So that qualifies to be complete bastards and little else.
And also the thing is, how, you know, I mean, these people are pre-selected by their parties, and of course we know the Liberal and Labor parties are only going to get the ones who get any money to actually run their campaigns properly. And, I mean, how big is the Labor Party, do you reckon, Stephen?
Oh, maybe, I'd have a fair few thousand members, I'd imagine, but not a huge amount.
So basically,
I can't be in the thousands, maybe tens of thousands, but not much.
This pre-selection has been filtered through a, you know, couple of tens of thousands of people, and they're selecting who is going to be the people who run to do it. So this idea that people are too stupid is, I think, very flawed. Now, this is the other. There's a sort of a similar argument that people are evil. They're just nasty. But the funny thing about this one is that if people are really nasty and evil and they can't be trusted, then why do we have a situation where we can have Mr. Howard sitting on at the very top, wielding basically
That's exactly the point. If people are evil, then you don't let them into positions of power. It's as simple as that. You don't give anyone the opportunity to be in a position like John Howard or a director of a company if they're evil.
Yeah.
I mean, if people are evil, then direct democracy is the best way to go.
So there's other sort of more complex arguments about it just wouldn't work, but I can see that we're running out of time.
Yes, we are running out of time, but just coming back to the people are stupid. If people are not necessarily going to want to take an interest in everything. I mean, I don't mean they're going to let other people run riot over them. But people will have interest in various areas, and they'll pick up areas they're interested in, and they'll become quite well informed on those areas. And therefore, we'll be quite in a position to make quite a valid decision on various issues. And in terms of, very, very quickly, because we are running out of time, people often talk about, just the sheer size of it all. But I think the point you've got to realise is that you're not going to have people in Canberra making decisions about what's happening in Broome. If it doesn't affect the people in Canberra, and vice versa, people in Broome are not going to be making decisions about what's happening in Canberra if it doesn't affect them. So, whereas now we have a government that at various levels, federal, state, local, make decisions essentially about everything, I mean, that wouldn't necessarily be the case under a direct democracy system. I mean, it would be stupid to have people in Canberra, having to make decisions on what's happening in Broome, which is the situation now. To a certain extent with the way the government's structured, and more importantly, what right do people in Canberra have to be making decisions about what's happening in Broome if it doesn't affect them?
So to sum up, Vote Informal today, Direct Democracy tomorrow is doing a Direct Democracy campaign whereby we want to take away this idea that the government has our support because, as we know, we're forced to vote, and when we do vote, we're forced to give our preferences to one of the major parties. So if you want to get Vote Informal today, Direct Democracy tomorrow, registered as a party, which means we can get our names on little ballot papers and really raise
and
our profile.
Piss off Electoral Commissioner and other sundry people.
Start a shit fight, that's right. we need 500 members. And
this is our wonderful democracy we have now.
That's right, we've got to be limited to these... Well, arbitrary restrictions. But if you to join, you just need to sign two forms. And to get those forms, you can write to us here at Radio Freedom, which is radiofreedom@hotmail.com, or write to our PO Box, which is PO Box 3859, Western Creek, ACT 2611.
That is basically all we have time for. We are very rapidly running out of time. If you'd like any more information on the show, that is also the addresses that you can get in contact with us. And don't forget our website address, www.freespeech.org/radiofreedom/. Don't forget 2XX Open Day on Saturday the 26th of February in our studios in the Griffin Centre in the city. Basically come down and basically have a look around the studios, get more information on the station and sort of find out how you can get involved. If you want more information on that, give us a call, 62300100 during business hours at 62300100. We're going to finish up today with another track from Sick of It All. This is called Morally Confused, and we will return next week, next Friday at 11:00 a.m. as usual. Which will be 1 week away from our first anniversary show. So we can be all sentimental in a couple of weeks, can't we, James?
That's right.
Okay, we'll see you next week.